Okay, well, welcome to session 235 of the 2009 Salt Lake City Sunstone Symposium. I'm Clay Whitkey. I'm the chair for this session. Just a few announcements before we begin. Some of you may have noticed that we have a little giving tree out there in the main lobby, and during the symposium, you can actually show your support for Sunstone by buying an ornament for the giving tree, and then your donations that you make through the giving tree will be matched by a generous grant, making your donation go twice as far. And of course, when you purchase your donation, you get your little sunbeam button, kind of shows you're doing something good for Sunstone. In addition, I want to remind you that we prefer that you turn off all cell phones and noisemakers, or at least disable the noise. Levina's here, and she's going to back me up on that.
The fan lights are
here. All right, this session is actually two papers, so it's not necessarily a one paper and a respondent, but two separate papers. The first one will be delivered by William Russell. And William is a professor emeritus of American history and government at Graceland University in Lamoni, Iowa, where he taught for 41 years. He is a past president of both the Mormon History Association and the John Whitmer Historical Association, and has published widely in Mormon studies, including a recent book, Homosexual Saints, The Community of Christ Experience. His paper is on 25 years since the revelation on women, specifically in the Community of Christ, or RLDS, as they were formerly known. The second paper is on Women in the Priesthood, The Community of Christ Experience in the Invisible Ties That Bind. That will be given by Robin K. Linkhart, who has a Master's of Christian Ministry, is a 70, a field missionary coordinator for the West Central USA Mission for the Community of Christ. And without further ado, is William Russell.
Levina, our Danite coordinator, chairperson, is the true rock star of Sunstone, because she's the only one that you really only need to say one name, Levina. So it's kind of like, Cher and Madonna, Bono, folks like that. I've been all my adult life, I've been a political activist, and 2 years ago here in August of 2007, I wore my Obama t-shirt, and I was delighted to find some good, really good Obama supporters here at Sunstone, and when I circulated other parts of the lobby with other folks here, so that was very, very, very good feeling. But that campaign's all over, and now it's time for me to get on to the next campaign. So I've got my Smith Rigdon. This is, of course, a genuine 1844 T-shirt, of course, that I bought at the Community of Christ Visitor Center in Nauvoo. Now, it was mentioned that Robin is a 70. I'm really delighted to be on the program here with her. Her son was one of my best students I've ever had. She's a 70, but I'm 71, so I've got a little. That gives me a little something extra, I think. On Tuesday, April 3rd, 1984, President Wallace B. Smith presented a document to the World Conference in Independence, Missouri, asking the delegates to consider whether this particular statement should be accepted as divine guidance to the Church and be added to the Doctrine and Covenants in Section 156. In these situations, the document at first is considered by the various priesthood quorums, as well as a membership quorum, and then as well as a French language caucus and a Spanish language caucus. And these groups deliberate whether or not this should be seen as divine will and report their recommendation to the World Conference. Until recent times, it was fairly typical that for a document to be submitted in the morning, let's say on Tuesday of conference, and on Tuesday morning, it would go to the quorums, and the various quorums, and the membership quorum, and the language quorums would discuss it, and then they would report back to the conference in the afternoon, and then the delegates would discuss it further, and then there would be they would take an up or down vote. Do you see this document as the mind and will of God for addition to the Doctrine and Covenants, or not? And, you know, you can vote no. So a document that the delegates had not yet seen in print had only heard read a couple times in the morning and the afternoon, now, when voted for in the general conference delegate session, would now be scripture, even though we'd never seen it yet in print. It wouldn't be until the next morning we'd see it in print. And now it's scripture taking its place alongside the prophet Isaiah, the Gospel of Matthew, the Acts of the Apostles, etc., etc. I've often referred to this as instant canonization, arguing that the church should have several years to live with the document before we accept it as a revelation for the church. In 1984, however, it was not approved in one day. It was very controversial because of the ordination of women was involved in this document. And so it was not until the third day, on Thursday afternoon, late Thursday afternoon, that finally they took a vote, and the delegates had wrestled with this issue for nearly 3 days now. It passed easily, so they didn't take a counted vote, but observers have generally estimated that about 20% of the delegates voted against accepting this as a revelation. The largest dissent came from delegates living in or near the center place in Independence, Missouri. Many issues had been stirring in the church for about 25 years. The nature of Scripture, is it inerrant or not? Issues of history, both early Christian history and the Joseph Smith story, and various theological issues, many of which I think clustered around the question of ecclesiology or the nature of the church. There were lots of other divisions over the issues, but the ordination of women was the match that was the powder keg that set off a revelation. Revolution in the church. Revelation sends causes revolution, I guess. It was not until the next World Conference, held in our case 2 years later, in 1986, that critics of Section 156 had a chance to try to rescind the offensive revelation. For most of the critics who ultimately left the church, the conference of 1986 was their last stand. Several of the stakes in and around Independence elected a majority of delegates who were opposed to women's ordination, and they came to the 86 conference ready to do battle. They brought a motion to rescind Section 156. President Smith ruled the motion out of order on the basis that since the prophet is the only one who can bring a proposed revelation to the conference, the prophet is the only one who can bring a motion to rescind a revelation. 7 years later, church historian Dick Howard criticized President Smith's ruling in Volume 2 of his official history published by the church. I think Dick was absolutely right, as the delegates gave up their democratic right to have a say in an important aspect of the process of determining the canon of scriptures for the church. I sat in the balcony as an observer and couldn't believe my eyes when I saw the delegates vote approximately 10-1 in support of the ruling of the chair by President Smith. The delegates were so anxious to defeat the resolution to rescind Section 156 that they couldn't see the larger picture, and they went along with President Smith's ruling. But if they'd let the motion to rescind come for discussion and vote, then they would have passed probably better than 10-1. I mean, sorry, the would have been defeated by better than 10-1. And the fundamentalist critics would have had one less complaint. At least they could have made their motion, had it discussed, and then defeated. But when they don't have a chance to present it, in a democracy, that's a bad situation. So the first president had apparently taken a win-at-all-cost approach to this matter. Interestingly enough, 2 years earlier, at the very conference of 1984, where Section 156 was approved, President Smith did not rule out of order a motion from England that the Mark Hoffman forgery, called the Joseph Smith Blessing Letter, be added to the Doctrine and Covenants. Well, I guess we didn't call it a forgery because we didn't know yet that it was a forgery. Or we wouldn't have thought about it. But came to the floor for debate, and thankfully it was amended to put the letter in the appendix of the Doctrine and Covenants rather than in the main body. The appendix is where we'd move revelations we didn't like on baptism for the dead. So once you know, we don't put forgeries in the main body of Dr. Conan's suggestion. The previous 14 years had seen the church gradually move away from its past opposition to ordination of women. The church's official position had been not to allow it. A general conference resolution in 1905 had taken the position that women would not be ordained. The issue really began to be focused in the 1970 World Conference, at least the first trace of it, 14 years before it actually was adopted. At that conference that Bud Edwards, a delegate from Australia at the time, rose to offer an amendment that clearly implied the ordination of women. And when he got to that point in his statement that clearly was suggesting the ordination of women, there was a collective, I was sitting up in the press box, while we were looking there, and there's a collective gasp in the whole audience. I thought the dome on the auditorium would be lifted up to heaven to join Enoch's city of old. The matter was quickly laid on the table. They were not about to consider this in 1970. 1970 is also about the time in America that the feminist movement came into sharp focus. Betty Friedan's book, The Feminine Mystique, was published 7 years earlier, but it was several years before conversation began to percolate into the major media and so forth. And certainly by 1970, it was a big topic in American society. And some of our church people, especially educated women, but certainly others as well, were impressed with the need for changes in the church and in society. So in the 14 years between Bud Edwards' substitute motion in 1970 and the watershed 1984 World Conference, the issue of women's role in the church, and especially ordination, became frequent subjects of debate. And I, of course, don't pass up opportunities to tell both of our churches where they are wrong. So in 1973, I wrote a short letter in Dialogue in which I said the RLDS church people should not be so smug about the fact that we ordain black men while the Utah church forbids it, because the RLDS church refuses to ordain women, and that's just as bad. Every world conference from 1970 until 1984 dealt with the issue of women's role in the church, at least in some way. Chapter 35 of Dick Howard's two-volume History of the Church gives a good survey of the actions taken by the conference during that period. A natural beginning was to decide to include women in more decision-making roles, which do not require priesthood. So I thought I could bring some more light here. So under the leadership of Marjorie Tro, the church's new women's ministry consultant, the 1972 World Conference approved a resolution which stated, resolved that all those in administrative positions within the church be encouraged to appoint, hire, and nominate more women for positions not scripturally requiring priesthood, so that women who constitute over half of the church membership may be more adequately and equally represented in the administrative decision-making of the church. Rescinding that 1905 resolution, which had restricted priesthood to men, was another step forward. That happened when the first presidency, another step forward came in 1976, a big one, when in 1976 the presidency recommended and the conference approved a resolution affirming that we find no ultimate theological reason why women, if it were thought wise to do so, could not hold the priesthood, but that consideration of the ordination of women be deferred until it appears in the judgment of the first presidency that the church, by common consent, is ready to accept such ministry. To me, this was a clear sign. I'm looking back. It's a clear sign. Didn't think I saw it then, but clear sign that it was going to happen. We just have to wait until the first presidency was ready. In my view, we clearly would have ordained women eventually, sometime. We were not going to stand with the Roman Catholics, the Southern Baptists, and the Mountain Mormons, and deny women the priesthood. Interestingly enough, President W. Wallace Smith, who was still president in 1976, was well known as an opponent of women's ordination. He stated such in an interview in the Herald in 1970. Yet the first presidency recommended that the old resolution be rescinded. I suspect that is because he had two strong counselors, Morris Draper and Duane Cooey, who favored women's ordination. And sometimes they had to use a little muscle with the president. So I'm only guessing that, but I suspect that's why it came possibly over his objections, but yet with signature by the first presidency. Smith, much like his predecessor, his half-brother Israel Smith, who has been called a gentle monarch. He inherited the monarchy, but he realized it was a limited monarchy. So Israel A. and W. Wallace, I think, avoided being dictatorial. The 1982 conference adopted a motion requesting the first presidency to establish a task force whose goal would be to determine the feelings of church members on the issue of women's ordination. The first presidency was to report the task force's finding, and the presidency was to express its judgment to the 1984 World Conference, quote, on whether sufficient common consent existed in the church to warrant the ordination of women. The first presidency's report on these matters was to appear in the Herald no later than February 15, 1984. A task force was appointed, composed of Apostle Alan Tyree and seven others. The task force produced a survey and sent it to 1,460 persons. Nearly half were returned. However, 89% of those labeled as church leaders returned the survey, but only 21% of those who were not in the leadership category returned the survey. So the leaders were well represented in the survey responses, but the rank and file, not so much. Historian Dick Howard summarized the results of the survey as follows. About one-third of those who responded supported the ordination of women, only one-third. About one-half opposed the ordination of women. Some of those in the neutral camp, the other 17% or so, expressed willingness to follow the initiative of church leaders on the question of women's ordination. They would, follow the brother. That might be a statement you've heard before. Meanwhile, in February 1984, President Wallace B. Smith went on his usual retreat prior to World Conference, where he would write his World Conference sermon, which is seen as sort of a state of the church message from the president, given on the first day of the week-long conference. And on these retreats, he would try to discern whether there was something he should bring to the conference by way of divine guidance. When I interviewed him 18 years later, in 2002, he said, I didn't read that report of the survey, even though it came out about that time, would have come to their office before that time. He did that because he didn't want to know what the results of the survey was. I suppose he felt that if I'm going to bring something prophetic, I shouldn't be, just checking popular opinion. That's my surmise. In my interview with Wally, which is what people call him, he indicated his awareness that there can be tension between the prophetic and the pastoral. I'd ask him a question about the role of homosexuals in the church, and he said, homosexuality is probably inborn. The church needs to be completely true to the best Christian principles. We probably ought to accept homosexuals, including priesthood. But to do that is going to tear the church down the middle again in around 2000 compared to 1984 in women. It is once again one of those problems of the tension between the pastoral and the prophetic. At what point do you make your stand? How did we go from only one-third support for women's ordination? And then 6 months later, at World Conference, 80% of the delegates, approximately, voted for ordination. Possibly those who returned the survey were not a representative sample of the church. That's certainly, especially since only 20% of the rank and file members responded. But the leadership responded in great numbers, so it's really hard to judge. But perhaps more important is that the delegates to World Conference are not likely a representative sample of the church membership. Many of the delegates are leaders, and of course they're the ones that answer the survey more, although they're against it too, so it's really hard to read it. Many of the delegates are leaders in their local area, but there might be factors too, of wealth and education involved. It would seem likely that saints with more personal wealth would be more likely to travel the distances it takes to get to Independence for the conference and all the expense that takes. So they're more likely going to be elected delegates to the conference. And people with more personal income have, on average, more education. So possibly those with more education and personal wealth were more supportive of women's ordination. And those with more education and personal wealth are more likely to be leaders, too, in the congregations, such as pastor and sort of elected by the people as the pastor and so forth. Clearly, some delegates were opposed to women's ordination at the beginning of the week, but then were swayed because the prophet had brought this inspired counsel. But I'll cite one other factor. After conference, I saw my Graceland professor friend, the late Jim Hawley, And I said, someone Monday after conference, and I said, did you vote for Section 156? And he said, well, when it first came up on Tuesday, I was against it. But when it came up on Thursday, I voted in favor of it. I thought, you chicken, changing your opinion just because the prophet took a different position. But fortunately, I didn't say it. instead, I asked him why he changed his mind. He said, I came to realize that the only reason I had been opposed was prejudice. So, my respect for Jim grows. But anyway, some, like Jim, came to a new understanding as a result of the discussions held in the formal meetings and informal discussions between Tuesday and Thursday, and no doubt some were affected by private prayer. Soon, the First Presidency appointed a committee to draft guidelines for priesthood, which included a requirement that a person being ordained take certain short courses offered by the temple school. That offended the fundamentalists. Priesthood are called by God, and there are no educational requirements. That's quite clear in the Doctrine and Covenants. They also established a rule that no ordinations for women would be recommended to the higher ecclesiastical authorities before March of 1985, and nearly a year after the conference. And then that no women would be ordained prior to Sunday, November 17th, 1985. The presidency apparently did not want there to be a rush to recommend ordinations, nor a rush to ordain the first woman in the church. So although there were some ordinations in Australia that morning of November 7th, so I presume they were the first. I shouldn't have said that, I guess, but I suppose that would be the case. Okay, now for the reaction in the church. The negative reaction was significant. I estimate that in the next 6 years, about 20% of the active members of the church left, and many joined with other local splinter groups. And there were three types of such groups that formed. By far the largest number affiliated with what they call independent restoration branches, which meant that they would function independently of the RLDS hierarchy. They would teach their traditional restoration messages and not the liberal heresies that are apparently coming out of headquarters. And they would only organize local branches and not a new general church. That meant they would only ordain local priesthood officers, which for them would be deacons, teachers, priests, and elders, but not any 70s or the various kinds of high priests that we have in the church structure. Some of these people also encouraged their people not to resign their RLDS church membership, hoping that someday the leadership would come to their senses and reject these liberal heresies. On the other hand, some people were more like the Puritan separatists in the 17th century who just lost all hope for the Church of England, and so there's no use sticking around, and they resigned their membership. As I said, by far the largest number of those joined new groups called independent restoration branches, by far the largest. A second type of group emerged, groups which began the process of organizing a new general church, which would include these higher priesthood offices. Some elders naturally thought that they were the priesthood body most qualified to set the church in order, because after all, the early conferences in the 1830s were elders' conferences. Four prominent fundamentalist elders called for an international elders' conference held in Independence in 1985 and 86. But after three or four meetings, the organization fell apart because a faction of the leadership tried to use the conference to promote John Cato of Independence as the new prophet of the church. The International Elders Conference, as it was called, rejected their attempt, but their faction called the Zion's branch ordained Cato as the prophet anyway. He produced revelations, and things were going fine for about a year, when suddenly Cato and his whole extended family joined the Mormon church. Zion branch still exists, but very small in number. Another faction of the International Elders Conference were elders from Michigan, my home state, who proceeded in 1987 to organize the Church of Christ Restored. They called apostles, but yet, 22 years later, they have not called a prophet president for their group. They remain mostly in Michigan, and they remain small. It is not surprising that some 70s thought, well, they're the quorum to set things in right again. So since there is that notion in the Doctrine and Covenants that the 70s are a third presidency, and so the First Presidency and the Second Presidency, the 12, Dale Luffin's group, they're out of order, they're in apostasy. So they began organizing what became called the Restoration Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, begun by six men who were fundamentalist 70s. I guess somehow six men organizing a church has a kind of familiar ring to it, I guess. This church, the Restoration Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, began with a little over 1,000 members, but division after division left them with only about 100 members a decade later. The 70s were not successful in bringing the church to order. The man they chose as their prophet was Marcus Juby. He, like John Cato, produced several revelations, his for a decade or so, to guide the church. And then, like John Cato, he too up and joined the Mormon church. But at least Juby, you know, lasted a decade before he collapsed. I mean, joined the Mormon church. So I've been keeping a wary eye on Community of Christ President Steve Vesey, make sure he doesn't defect to the Mount Mormon. Some of the high priests thought, well, we're the ones that should be reforming the church. It kind of reminds me of Al Franken's earlier book called Why Not Me for President? Or more accurately, their quorum, the high priest. So by about the year 2000, a new church was formed from among men who had been involved in the earlier schismatic groups. The key leaders of this new church were high priests. Again, they have a little passage in the Doctrine and Covenants to rely on, so they felt they had scriptural warrant. The key leaders of the new church were high priests, mostly living in and around Independence. They took the name the Remnant Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. They began with slightly less than 1,000 members, and while they've had their internal divisions, they have nearly doubled that figure to about 2,000 at this time after 9 years. The Secretary of State's office at the Missouri Capitol, Jefferson City, seems to me they've probably been kept busy the last 25 years filing incorporation papers for various splinter groups, including many local independent branches that will file various names, so they nail that name down. One of my favorite is the Church of Jesus Christ, the Righteous Branch. Its attraction is what the name suggests about the various other unrighteous branches, I guess. Another good one is the Church of Christ at Halley's Corner. Phil Barlow, I know, would especially appreciate their sense of the importance of place. Okay, a third type of group emerged. Like the second type of group, they are small in numbers and members. These are the groups that are led by a self-proclaimed prophet. There the movement starts at the top with a self-proclaimed prophet. Stan King of Wan Sound, Ontario, was probably the first self-proclaimed prophet, proclaiming about 1969 or 1970, well before the women's revelation, that he was a prophet and started his group. He's fairly successful. He converted a couple thousand people in India. But he died about 6 years later. Now, before he died, now he's kind of an optimistic fellow, I guess, because before he died, he told his disciples not to bury him if he died because he'd be resurrected, I presume on the third day. But at any rate, so I guess when he died, the family just kind of kept the body around the house. Soon the provincial authorities in Ontario moved in and made the family dispose of the body in a proper way. And he has not been resurrected, at least not as far as I know. And another self-proclaimed prophet was Gene Walden of Independence, Missouri. He declared himself a prophet and produced revelations, but he never attracted more than his family and a few close friends. Finally, even his wife divorced him and was granted alimony. He refused to pay the alimony because, claiming religious freedom, his obligation to preach the gospel left him no time to make money and for alimony. The judge wasn't impressed and threw him in jail. So a lot of these self-proclaimed prophets didn't come out too well. Bob Baker of Independence was more successful in attracting followers. He had several hundred at least. In 1991, Phil Barlow and I had the privilege of attending a Sunday service in Independence. Phil, with his sense of the importance of geography and religious movements, was very impressed that in three places in the sanctuary, they had a map disclosing the four corners of Zion. Now, you might not know where they're at. Of course, Independence is the center place, but the northeast corner of Zion is up around Davenport, Iowa, and the southeast is kind of about in the Missouri panhandle. The northwest is out around someplace in western Nebraska, and the southwest would be someplace like in Oklahoma. And Phil was really impressed. And now, most of you LDS people are totally outside the habitation of Zion. I regret to report that to you. But anyway, now, the worst is yet to come. There are two self-proclaimed prophets who I think easily fit the definition of cult employed by Jan Shipps in her 1985 book, Mormonism. A cult is led by a charismatic figure who teaches significantly new dogmas, departing from the received tradition. The other groups are sects who are trying to recover a lost tradition, trying to get back to the church the way it was in the 1950s or 60s. But a cult leader takes them off in a whole new direction. We are happy that, the two self-proclaimed prophets who easily fit this definition are, the first is Jeff Lundgren, who murdered a family of five who were part of his cult in Kirtland, Ohio in 1989. A year earlier, he'd wanted to kill his stake president, Dale Luffman, and his wife and three sons, but he didn't, and Dale's sitting there right now today. The plot was thwarted because one cult member fled and told the authorities, and by various means and with wonderful maneuvering by the chief of police, this didn't happen. Dale Luffman was the stake president at the time, and Jeff was convinced that God was very angry with Dale and wanted Jeff to take care of him. But anyway, he committed different murders a year later, and the state of Ohio did not appreciate Jeff Lundgren's activity on behalf of his angry God, and they executed him in October 2006. I served as an expert witness for the defense at Jeff's trial. We are happy to say that we have only had one cult murder where our Utah cousins have had several. But if you look at it on a proportional basis, I guess we got you beat. Some of my MHA friends told me that after the general Lundgren. Well, we're kind of glad to see one happen to you guys. We lost a lot of members as a result of Section 156 and related issues. Clearly, we were losing liberal members for quite some time before 1984 because the church moved so slow to adapt to the modern world and women's ordination and other issues. But once we were clearly in the liberal ecumenical reformist camp, whatever you want to call it, we had a flood of conservatives leave. We proceeded fairly rapidly to ordain women to many offices in the priesthood, but we were a little slow getting women into the Council of Twelve. That took 13 years. There are four apostles now, and many of you met Susan Score last year and 3 years ago. In 2007, Becky Savage was called to the first presidency, so we've had women in every office. Today, there are many women serving as pastors, regional officers, mission center presidents, that's our what we used to call stake presidents, and bishops and so forth. All four congregations in this area, Salt Lake, Ogden, Orem, and Pocatello, have had women as pastors. Women are exercising priesthood functions and have really leavened the loaf. In fact, I think Deacon Dale Luffman passed out a brochure about women in the priesthood, so you're welcome to have one if you like it. Studies have concluded that women are, on average, more nurturant than men. Is there a more important quality for ministry than being a nurturing person? In the church in Lamoni, I've sometimes been in a position of advising the worship committee or the stake president or somebody else on how to minister to marginalized people, such as single people or gays and lesbians. And sometimes a person will suggest, well, let's have an evangelist take care of this, or what you call patriarchs. Then I look down the list of local evangelists, and I say, my mind turns to the social workers, all of whom are women, only one of whom is currently in the priesthood, but they're all healers. My thesis is that women, my hypothesis, I guess I should say, women and gays are more spiritual than straight men. Partly because they've been oppressed. I mean, look at the black church. I think there's plenty of evidence with regard to my contention about women and about the black church. I'm not as sure that there's been such research about gays. But at any rate, over the centuries, straight men have had to control women and gays by excluding them from priesthood power, positions of power such as the priesthood. People in power don't give up their power voluntarily. And they are the ones who make the rules. And the rules are made to help reinforce